You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 18th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jane Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
How is everyone tonight?
Pretty good.
Super. Happy birthday to David Vedder. Do you guys know who David Vedder is?
He's the Bubba Boy.
He's the lead singer of...
Pearl Jam.
Yes, thank you. Pearl Jam.
That's Eddie?
Yes.
That's close, though.
Close, that's his brother.
Oh, they must be.
David Vedder was the Bubba Boy, as Steve correctly guessed, and no one listened. He was pretty famous in the 70s and 80s and inspired movies like Bubble Boy, which was, of course, the greatest movie Jake Gyllenhaal has ever starred in.
Wait, I thought John Travolta was the Bubble Boy.
No, it's Jake Gyllenhaal.
No, Travolta did it like a long time
ago. Yeah, that's older version.
That was the boy in the bubble. And I'm not sure, is that the same story? About the same
person?
Was
that like a TV, made-for-TV movie?
Yeah,
something like that.
And then there was also the Seinfeld episode with the boy in the bubble who turned out to be a gigantic jerk.
Yeah.
Well, that is actually apparently really close to reality. Although reality is less funny and quite sad.
I don't know. If you were stuck in a bubble, you know, forever, you might be jaded to a certain degree as well.
Well, yeah, jaded is actually a really light word to apply to what happened to David. Like, he was severely psychologically impacted by spending literally his entire life, besides the first 10 seconds or so after being born and the last couple of days before he died, inside a bubble. He had severe combined immunodeficiency, which is a hereditary disease. His older brother was born with it and died pretty soon after he was born. And doctors told the mother and the father, David and Carol, that any other boy they have would stand a 50% chance of contracting this disease. But they went ahead and they tried to have another baby anyway, and they had David. And David, they also had a little girl, I should mention, who didn't have the disease. So David did have the disease. They were ready for it, though, of course, and they shuttled him immediately into this bubble. He lived at the hospital for the first couple of years of his life, and then they built another bubble at home and also a mobile bubble to get him from the hospital to his home. And yeah, that's where he spent his life. At one point, NASA built him a suit so that he could go out of the bubble a little ways, like still connected through a tunnel into the bubble, but apparently the suit was really bulky and he could only just walk out into the yard and that was it. And so he just used it a couple of times apparently and then grew out of it and never bothered with it again. So for the most part, he was just stuck in a room his whole life. And yeah, he hated it, obviously. Like, as he got older, he started having to come to terms with the fact that he would probably never be able to leave the bubble. And that made him super depressed, which I think is pretty understandable.
Oh,
but the case, you know, obviously got very famous. He was just known as Bubble Boy or David. His last name wasn't released until 10 years after his death in order to protect the privacy of his family. In part, I think, because there was a lot of criticism of his family, you know, his parents deciding to go ahead and have another boy, despite the fact that they knew there was a 50% chance that he would be born with this disease. In fact, there was the chaplain at the hospital where he was born accused the doctors there of convincing the parents to go ahead with the birth so that they would have a subject to test out this new treatment on. But the doctors, of course, denied it. Nothing ever came of that. And also, they never, you know, in David's lifetime, they didn't manage to cure it. They tried to give him a bone marrow transplant in the end with his sister. But unfortunately, the bone marrow was contained an inactive virus, Epstein-Barr, which ended up like immediately taking over his body and killing him. He was 12 years old when he died. So kind of sad, very sad, but it's become a cultural touchstone of sorts. So
yeah,
happy birthday to David.
And bone marrow transplant is still really the only treatment for this combined immunodeficiency syndrome. However, there are clinical trials looking at gene therapy, swapping a gene that actually works. That would be a much better cure. Bone marrow transplants are always tricky business, you know.
Yeah.
They're great when they work, but very high risk.
Yeah, and apparently his sister wasn't even considered a match when he was born, yeah, because that's when they were going to do the transplant. But I never was able to really figure out why. I guess things just progressed to the point where they had to do something, so yeah, they tried the
They could
anyway.
Not find a matched donor, so out yeah. of desperation, they did an unmatched donation from his sister. I think it was just, you know, just out of desperation.
Ugh.
Yeah.
A sad case. So we're going to move on to the 2013 Ig Nobel Prize winners. Rebecca, you usually take the lead on this item.
Yeah, I love the Ig Nobels. I haven't lived in Boston for a couple of years now, so I've missed them. Unfortunately, I always have to catch up online or on the radio. Usually, I think they play Thanksgiving Day. NPR will play the Ig Nobels in full. But until then, we can see the results. And I think this year was a banner year for weird science.
Yeah, it was good.
For those who are unaware, the Ig Nobels celebrate science that makes you laugh and then makes you think. Mm-hmm. And each year, a couple of Ig Nobels usually also go to mocking some sort of anti-science or backward-thinking person. But for the most part, it's about weird little nuggets of scientific discovery. So let's go through them. The Medicine Prize went to some Japanese researchers who assessed the effect of listening to opera on heart transplant patients who are mice.
What? Wait. These mice had heart transplants.
Yes.
And then they assessed their emotional state. Is that what you're saying?
No, their survival.
Well, their health, their health, not their, how they felt, like, emotionally.
I feel happy.
Oh, I'm still a mouse? What?
And what they found was a possible effect in the advantage of playing the opera music in prolonging the mice's survival.
Specifically, yeah. La Traviata.
Yes.
They did not control for the language of the opera.
No.
That's
a follow-up study.
So the other mice that didn't listen to opera died earlier because they weren't listening to opera.
That's what they found.
Correlation doesn't equal causation necessarily. But yeah, the ones who listened to opera happened to live longer.
Okay.
Hmm. The prize for psychology, I really love this one. I think this might be my favorite. A group of mostly French researchers who confirmed that people who think they are drunk also think they are attractive. And the title of the paper is Beauty is in the Eye of the Beer Holder.
Oh,
people
man.
Who think, yeah.
Very
people
good,
who maybe. Think they are drunk also think they are attractive.
I mean, that and, right there gets them the Ig Nobel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when they say people who think they are drunk, that's what they mean. They don't mean people who are drunk think they are attractive. They actually gave alcohol to some people, and they gave a non-alcoholic beverage to others, didn't tell, and then they lied to half of each group. So there were some people who got alcohol and thought that they were getting a non-alcoholic beverage, and, you know, vice versa. Some who got alcohol and knew it, you know.
So four groups, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they had the people give talks, and the talks were graded by judges. And the participants also self-graded. And what they found was that the people who drank alcohol said that they did better than the judges said. And also the people who drank non-alcoholic drinks but thought that it was alcoholic and thought that they were drunk also thought that they did better than the judges thought they did.
Wow, that is really lame.
What does that mean? What the hell does that mean, though?
Yeah, I think it just means that thinking effect? You're drunk probably increases your self-confidence in a way.
Or does it just make you act drunk, and do people think that acting drunk includes self-confidence or bravado?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
It's just a placebo effect for alcohol.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was the psychology prize. There was a joint prize in biology and astronomy. This was great. It went to researchers who published the paper "Dung Beetles Use the Milky Way for Orientation."
It's a great story.
I love
story.
That. But
didn't we talk about that study?
I think we did. When I read that, I thought, wait, is this the Ig Nobel from last year? Because I thought
no, yeah, we that was familiar to me too. I think we covered it.
We definitely
well, how was earlier in this year.
It was published back in January.
Yeah, how are they doing it? Are they looking at it?
They got to be looking at the Milky Way.
It has to be visual. Because on cloudy nights, the beetles would lose the orientation that they would otherwise have on the starry nights.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So one of the sillier prizes was the Safety Engineering Prize, which went to Gustavo Pizzo, unfortunately deceased, who invented, and I'm just going to quote from them, an electromechanical system to trap airplane hijackers. The system drops a hijacker through trapdoors, seals him into a package, then drops the encapsulated hijacker through the airplane's specially installed bomb bay doors, whence he parachutes to Earth, where police, having been alerted by radio, await his arrival. That's so U.S. patent 3811643.
So how do you lure... like the guy over the big X on the floor.
Yeah.
Like
and what if there's more than one hijacker?
It's in front of
the
cockpit.
Nobody's saying it's a perfect system. But considering
but
that this patent was filed in 1972. So I think
an award in,
this guy
in 74.
Was ahead of his time.
Rebecca, so you're on the airplane and the hijacker's standing there yelling and he's got some gun or some knife thing. And then you're like, could you take one step closer to me? You know, like what, how?
Well, there are clever ways you could incite like, the madman. you could insult him in some way,
but where's the plunger button
toward you?
Where's this big red button that you got to smash with your fist in order to get the floor to
maybe it's in the bathroom, the trapdoor, and with the understanding that even terrorists have to use the toilet at some point. And
all right, I would buy that. Maybe, why can't the toilet just suck them in?
Well, it probably could. There is an urban legend about that very thing, but...
not true, though.
The physics prize went to a group of researchers who found that people can run on the surface of a body of water at simulated reduced gravity. In other words, according to the Ig Nobels, if those people and that pond were on the moon.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
You may have seen the Mythbusters episode about this, where they wanted to see if it was possible to run so fast that you stayed afloat. And I think that what they had to do was eventually just create a large pool
pontoons
of non-Newtonian liquid
then
were able to run across, which was amazing.
I love that video.
Yeah, but this is another fun try at a similar problem.
So gravity counts when trying to run on water.
Yeah, who knew? I mean, besides everybody with common sense.
Well, in essence, then,
if
you were lighter, like, I don't know what the equation would be, but like, what if you had the same strength in your body, but you weighed a quarter of your body weight? Would you be able to run on the water?
Well,
I don't think strength factors in that much, though. More surface area,
right? Yeah,
would be important and light. I mean, surface. You know, you're going to break that surface tension. You know, if you're bigger than a bug, pretty much.
No, what about that lizard that can run on the water?
The basilisk lizard.
There you go.
Yeah, Jesus lizard.
Yep.
Okay, the prize for chemistry went to Japanese researchers who wrote a paper on an onion enzyme that makes the eyes water. So they're determining exactly what it is about chopping onions that makes us cry.
Now, this is why every now and then the Ig Nobels give a prize out to something that I think is just perfectly straightforward, reasonable research. I don't get why they think it's so funny.
I think so, too. And the only thing I can assume is that this paper provided them with opportunities for a lot of good jokes about crying.
Maybe that was it. But this is actually what's interesting about this study, actually, is that it was previously thought that the same compound that gives the onion its flavor is the one that results in the lacrimatory or the enzymes that make you cry. But what they discovered is actually a different previously undiscovered enzyme. That opens the way for genetically engineered onions that retain their flavor and nutritional value but don't make you cry. That's what's important about this.
It's a breakthrough. You know what? If you don't cry, it's not the same. It's not the same experience.
I disagree.
If you don't cry, so it's in love.
So the flavor and nutritional value of the onion are not connected to this enzyme which causes us to tear up.
That's what the new research shows, and that opens the way for non-tearing onions.
It's called the jerk enzyme.
I thought that there was almost no nutritional value in an onion.
No, onions are great.
What? I've asked this before. Mm. What's in an onion that's good for you? I couldn't find it.
Slow down there, Happy.
I actually looked it up online. I couldn't find any data.
You Googled what's in an onion that's good for you?
Something like that.
I'm going to Google that right now. SweetOnionSource.com says onions are good for you.
Sweet.
It's a 4,000-year-old healer. It's a modern-day preventative. onions help prevent thrombosis and reduce hypertension, according to the American Heart Association.
You got to cook onions in panacea.
Really?
Oh, boy. Very good.
Onions are a good source of vitamin B6, folate, potassium, manganese, and vitamin C.
You don't need any of that shit.
Vitamin C?
Steve found a better website than I did.
B17 would be nice.
The prize for archaeology went to the most disgusting thing I've ever heard of in my life. And when I looked at I could not believe that the date on this study was 1995. I would have thought seriously that it was like 1886. Okay. So I'm going to read directly from the Ig Nobel website. So you know that I'm not making this up. Brian Crandall and Peter Stahl got the prize for parboiling a dead shrew and then swallowing the shrew without chewing and then carefully examining everything excreted during subsequent days. Also, they could see which bones would dissolve inside the human digestive system and which bones would not. Oh. So to recap, boiled a dead shrew and ate it whole, just swallowed it down, and then sifted through their poop to look at the shrew that came out.
But look Rebecca, look at the bones.
Yes. So, nice. But honestly, what do you really have to gain? Like, what does humanity have to gain from this? Like, what's cooked in there that we're gonna like? Is this a cure for cancer somewhere hidden in this?
Well, no. This is
ancient diets, right?
Yeah, this is archaeological. So they're looking at a lot of what we know about a lot of animals comes from what ends up in their feces. And so this could help put into context what kind of bones they find and where they find them and whether they find them or not. But it's really disgusting.
How do you swallow a shrew without chewing it?
I don't know. Like in my head, shrews are several inches long, right? Which is way too long to just swallow whole.
I mean, they said it was segmented, Rebecca.
Yeah, they did cut it off.
Oh, okay. So they did slice it.
It was skinned,
its
eviscerated, and segmented.
Okay.
Ugh. Never mind.
But it's little bones.
Jeez. How did your gag reflex not take over at that point?
Just they're about the size of
when you think about it.
Of a field mouse, I guess, right?
Yeah.
All right. We just got a couple more. Another silly one was the Peace Prize, which went to the president of Belarus for making it illegal to applaud in public and the Belarus State Police for arresting a one-armed man for applauding.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's kind of let that one sit there.
Was he slapping his face to clap? Like, what was he doing?
Well, nobody knows what the sound was. So the prize for probability went to some researchers in the UK for making two discoveries. Number one, the longer a cow has been lying down, the more likely that cow will soon stand up. And number two, once a cow stands up, you cannot easily predict how soon that cow will lie down again.
No.
This comes from the paper, easily. Are cows more likely to lie down the longer they stand? Yeah.
It's an enduring mystery.
You know, Evan, lots of other sciences are going to pull from that paper. Just want you to know.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it's been cited. The Public Health Prize went to Thai researchers for the paper Surgical Management of an Epidemic of Penile Amputations in Siam, which was published back in 1983 during a time, apparently, and during an epidemic of penis choppings brought on by a well-publicized case in which an angry wife apparently chopped off the penis of her husband, and this inspired an outbreak of penile amputations.
What year was the Bobbitt case?
That was much later. That was the 90s, right?
So there was 90, there was a, four or so. A Bobbitt case in Thailand in the 80s, I guess.
Apparently, yes.
Which That's led to surprising. An epidemic. I mean, an epidemic? Are they really?
Copycat. Oh,
is that hyperbole? Amputations. I mean, what are they trying to do? Scare every man out of this country? What's going on?
Now, they were developing a surgical technique to reattach the penises.
Yeah.
So that's, mm-hmm. again, perfectly legitimate medical paper.
It was a long, hard process, though.
Oh. Right.
But apparently, the surgery did not work in one case where the penis was partially eaten by a duck.
A duck.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
They still haven't found a cure for that.
That was a crime most foul.
Oh.
And was...
What the hell?
Thank God that is the last one. Let's move on.
Yes.
Is there a head researcher on this paper?
He's been let go.
Please. Steve, segue.
No, wait. There's more.
All right. Bob, you're going to take us out of this extremely improbable bit of news to talk about really improbable things.
Happen. Yeah, even more improbable. Have you guys been feeling an increased sense of urgency lately?
You mean like to pee or something?
I have.
Now that urinary,
now
urinary
that you
urgency?
Say it.
No, I have. And maybe it's because our universe may only have another 10 billion years left, or even much less than that. Which actually, that sounds like a long time, and it certainly is. But I've been thinking that we'd have, 100 billion, a trillion, you know, depending how you define the end of the universe. But it actually could potentially end in less than 10 billion years, or even tomorrow, potentially, based on this idea. So the deal here is that this could be the case if top quarks are just a little bit heavier than we think they are. And of course, on the other side of that coin is we could discover that they're actually lighter than we think they are. But in that case, some people have been talking about that maybe eventually in the universe we would see very weird things happening because of this, like disembodied brains appearing randomly out of seemingly nothing.
Well, the reason why they use that as an example is because
it's
of Boltzmann.
Boltzmann yeah. brains, yes, of yeah. course, of course. But even beyond that, just in general, you'll see. So the idea then is that how can the universe last just only another 10 billion years just because of a little quark? Well, the top quark, I wasn't aware of this. It's the most massive elementary particle. I knew it was massive. I didn't know it was the most massive. And it is the most unstable quark. Now, the up and down quarks, on the other hand, are very stable, which is nice since they make up all the protons and neutrons in all the atoms. So that's a good thing. But the top quark is actually so heavy. It's 180 times heavier than a proton. And get this one. This one quark is about as heavy as an atom of tungsten. One quark as heavy as an atom of tungsten.
Wow.
And tungsten has 74 protons and 110 neutrons. So this is a big boy. So a corpulent quark is okay, though, unless it's 3% heavier than we think. I just love alliteration. So this is possible since we're a bit uncertain exactly how much it weighs. You know, we're not 100% sure, of course. 3% more in either direction, more or less, is well within the error bars of what scientists think that the top quark weighs. But if it is, though, then Houston, we have a problem because the top quark mass and the Higgs boson mass have a certain ratio then that implies that the energy encompassing the vacuum of space, like virtual particles, for example, may be unstable and could destabilize one day. Destabilizing a vacuum, of course, is not a good thing. It doesn't sound good. So the way they describe it was like this. First you would see these microscopic tiny bubbles of vacuum destabilization. And this, because the vacuum has entered a new lower energy state, it would affect the Higgs field, causing it to have lower energy. And that's a really, really, really bad thing. The Higgs field imbues, as we've talked about many times, it imbues all particles with mass. So imagine you have these bubbles of destabilized vacuum expanding at the speed of light, changing the strength of the Higgs field, and in its wake, which therefore changes the mass of all the matter in its wake. You could essentially have this bubble intersecting the Earth, and then we're pretty much toast. Properties, you know, properties like mass and gravitation, they're so exquisitely balanced that life as we know it would pretty much certainly be wiped out if the Higgs field changed. So not a good day. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology. He said, if the vacuum destabilizes, we would all die. Physics and chemistry as we know them would become very different, and certainly no living creature would survive.
Sean Carroll, married to Jennifer Ouellette, who
yes.
we've had on the show.
Yeah. But then we got, on the other hand, and this one is actually, it's so hard to explain exactly what they're talking about here. On the other hand, if the top quark is less massive than we think, then that could lead to a universe which is with a much longer life. It would be much longer than 10 billion, much, much longer. Then this, though, in turn implies this whole Boltzmann brain problem. Now, this is related to the canonical monkey and the typewriters. You know, you give enough monkeys and enough typewriters enough time, and they could randomly just write Hamlet, for example. The idea here is that in a very, very old universe, random fluctuations could by chance bring together particles by pure chance that could be anything really allowed by physics, including a jar of peanut butter, which would be nice, or even a bare brain, the so-called Boltzmann brain, with a lifetime of fake memories that it would think were genuine. So the idea then is that statistically, more of these Boltzmann brains would exist than conventional ones that evolved over time. And that's apparently a problem that these physicists don't like. And it seems a little bit more philosophical to me than purely just a real physics question. It's something that was that made it the story more crazy and exotic and really got your attention. But yeah, so what? I mean, yeah, you could have give a centillion years, you can have a lot of crazy shit just by accident, just coming together, just because of random quantum fluctuations. So I mean, so what? I mean, it's an interesting intellectual diversion, but. I think the idea of the top quark, though, is more interesting. The fact that if it's just a little bit more massive, then the universe would have a greatly abbreviated lifespan. I mean, 10 billion years is not really a long time. They're saying that these bubbles should appear like roughly once every 20 billion years. So we're 13 and a half billion years in, so it could happen.
So any day now.
In less than 10 billion years. Or, yeah, it could conceivably. I mean, there could be a bubble of destabilized vacuum heading toward us right now. And we would never
but
even know.
This,
but it would be over really quick.
This universe is where I keep all my stuff.
Bob. Hey, Bob.
Yo.
Now, will we be able to measure these to get a more accurate reading at some point?
Yeah, it's a good question, Jay. So, yeah. So, the LHC will be able to measure the top quark more accurately and narrow those error bars for the mass of the top quark to definitively know one way or the other. You know, is it heavier than we think or is it lighter than we think? You know, which direction the universe might go into? So yeah, so we'll have to wait and see what the LHC tells us.
All right, very interesting. Jay, you're going to tell us about a scientist who thinks that he has discovered alien life on Earth.
I would like to start with something interesting.
You need to cut out all your loser crybaby crap right now and think of something scientific.
Pinkman!
Good quote.
Breaking Bad is so epic. There's two more episodes. I'm losing my mind. I love this show so much. That quote is a very easy segue into this very interesting but somewhat unbelievable claim here. So there's a team of British scientists at the University of Sheffield who are led by astrobiologist Professor Chandra Wickramasinghe. Thank you. And they think that they have discovered actual alien life. They sent a balloon into the stratosphere. That's 27 kilometers or 16.7 miles or 54,790 feet, which is
how many leagues?
That's considered the edge of space. And the balloon took samples and returned a small biological organism or a collection of organisms that the scientists say can only come from space. And they believe that these organisms were transported by passing meteors. The team's balloon was sent up during the Perseid meteor shower.
Yeah.
You guys know this meteor shower is visible from mid-July to August 24th, and I checked the dates. It's like pretty much always ends on the 24th.
Yeah. I saw some this year. Finally had some good weather to view some this year.
We did not.
Yeah. Oh, I did.
Here. I haven't had good weather in literally 10
20 years.
To 12 years.
Right, Bob?
I'm not kidding.
So during this event, they set the balloon up and it was fitted with sterile microscopic slides, and they exposed the slides only at altitude, you know, which I said was 27 kilometers. And once the slides were recovered, they found that there were microscopic aquatic algae on there. Like, that's pretty profound.
Aquatic.
Base algae?
What? Yep. The professor said biological entities of this nature have not previously been reported occurring in the stratosphere. The entities varied from a presumptive colony of ultra-small bacteria to two unusual individual organisms, part of a diatom frustule. F-R-U-S-T-U-L-E. I am not a biologist.
Frustule?
He said it was 200 micron-sized particle mass interlaced with biofilm and biological filaments. And he said these findings were evidence for the theory of cometary panspermia. For those of you who don't know what panspermia is, first off, it's the Greek word for seed everywhere, seeds everywhere. And the idea behind panspermia is that some form of biology is spread from planet to planet, either astronomically close or far, by meteors or other traveling debris. This theory also speculates that life on Earth may have originated from this process. Now, I think that that is possible. Absolutely. Panspermia, to me, is plausible. We don't have proof either way. But if indeed these scientists did find a alien type of algae, I think it adds to this idea. But I have a few questions. First of all, are we 100% sure that this algae doesn't exist on Earth? Does it have anything remotely similar to it on Earth? Is it possible, like they were saying, that only a volcanic eruption could push debris up that far and it wouldn't last long in that part of the stratosphere? I just feel like there's a lot of untested things going on here that we haven't really figured out whether or not this stuff is from Earth.
Yeah, I mean, his line of argument is very thin, in my opinion. He's essentially saying that just physically, he doesn't know how these particles would get up into the stratosphere. Therefore, they came down from space. But that's kind of a massive argument from ignorance. You know, it's a very thin argument to base the conclusion that these are extraterrestrial.
It's ridiculous. How could you almost dare to say it's extraterrestrial unless you have a smoking gun like a triple helix or something that's obviously not Earth biology.
Calm down, Bob.
It's like what the hell?
So that's number two. Is until you do look at the biology and show that it's not terrestrial, you're just blowing smoke. Yeah. And three is, you know, we do need to make absolutely sure that this was not contaminant, that this was actually, you know, taken from the stratosphere, not at any other portion of the flight. So we need some replication, we need biological investigation, and we need to also look at the, you know, explore the properties of these things further to really decide whether or not it's possible they could have gotten up into the stratosphere from the Earth. So the whole thing is very thin. He's got wildly speculative hypotheses at best.
Why is this in the news cycle if it hasn't already?
Exactly.
The bottom line is this event happens every year. They can easily set up another experiment for next year and really double down on this, get other people to do it as well. I think the news was reported way too early. I think that the scientists did not answer all the questions, the obvious skeptical questions. They didn't answer them. You know, like Steve said, he comes out with like one answer that kind of is supposed to be like, well, look, you know, because this stuff couldn't have gotten there any other way. It had to come from the top down, not from the bottom up. Well, I don't agree with that. I think there's a lot of different ways. You know, what about the actual balloon itself having the algae on it? You know, was the balloon sterile?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, you've got to cross all your T's and dot all your I's before you claim alien. And they haven't done that here. We'll keep an eye on this one. Who knows? But this is not demonstrably wrong. It's just way premature and wildly speculative.
My prediction, we will never hear about this again.
Yeah, probably. That's statistically probably correct. All right, let's move on. We're sort of working our way down the ladder of pseudoscience here.
Started at the Ig Nobels.
And we started at the Ig Nobels.
Yeah, that's good point.
Did you guys hear that science proves homosexuality is unnatural?
Oh my God. I read this.
Those bonobos are going to be so shocked.
Yeah, my jaw hit the floor. Steve, I still kind of think it's satire.
It's
made up. Yes.
It is so bad. It is beyond satire. It absolutely is indistinguishable from a Poe, meaning something that is fake and ridiculous.
Well, no, that's what a poem means. A poem means something that's indistinguishable.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It is already a poem.
But as far as I could tell, the news outlet is legitimate. It's not like The Onion. You know, everything seems to check out, but yeah, I wouldn't be shocked if this were a clever hoax, but it seems legit. So this is a research study that comes out of Nigeria, and it is being promoted like propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
The researcher said that he did research to show that homosexuality is unnatural. His research consisted of demonstrating that the like poles of a magnet repel each other.
Oh, no. No.
He actually had to conduct experiments to confirm that.
Is he in sixth grade?
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Because
this is like...
This is
more of a fourth grade. You don't have kids,
yeah,
Rebecca. This is more like fourth grade.
Okay. Yeah. I was a very slow child.
Yeah. That was his big, big research. And so therefore, he's just using a physics analogy to quote-unquote prove something morally about human behavior.
So who is this moron? What's this guy's name?
Absurd.
Asshole.
This is
bigot.
He's a graduate of the University of Lagos in Nigeria. And Jay, his name is harder to pronounce than the other guy. Amalaha is his last name.
Okay.
This is a quote now from him. To start with, physics is one of the most fundamentals of all the sciences, and I used two bar magnets in my research. A bar magnet is a horizontal magnet that has the North Pole and the South Pole. And when you bring two bar magnets and you bring the North Pole together, you find that the two North Poles will not attract. They will repel. That is, they will push away themselves, showing that a man should not attract a man. If you bring two South Poles together, you find that the two South Poles will not attract, indicating that the same-sex marriage should not hold.
That's insane.
I want to know how we decided that the North Pole was the man and the South Pole was a woman.
Well,
that's what I want to know.
Clear heaven and hell.
Did he consider one of those horseshoe-shaped magnets that gets to hook up with anybody they want? That's okay,
His Bible didn't cover
that. The news report reported his findings as a quote-unquote breakthrough.
Oh, yeah.
What news?
Were his co-authors Shaggy Two Dope and Violent J?
So then he used math, which is even more fundamental.
Wow,
physics.
Now he's getting really sophisticated.
Jay, do you know that? Are you aware of the fact that 6 times 8 and 8 times 6 both give you the same result?
Dun, dun, dun.
Come on, don't be ridiculous.
Therefore, homosexuality is wrong.
Wait. Let's start
QED.
Did you not follow that in ineluctable logic, Rebecca?
I think I might have missed something.
I mean, that's it. That's all he's got.
Wait, who's the 6 and who's the 8 and shouldn't it be a 9?
Yeah, I agree, right? What's up with that?
I mean, it's almost bizarre.
I know, Rebecca, he turned the 69 on its head. I mean, this guy is a revolutionary.
So then he goes out just to make some blatantly false claims. Like he says that animals do not exhibit homosexual behavior. Patently wrong.
True.
There is, in fact, a Wikipedia website, list of animals displaying homosexual behavior with quite a few entries.
Satan planted that Wikipedia article.
Yeah.
Satanpedia or Wiki Satan.
And I wrote about this, you know, the title of my blog post was Science Proves I'm Right. You know, this is people superficially trying to use, science to prove some political, ideological, moral belief correct. And it is usually plagued by, horrendous assumptions, and they're not even challenging their own assumptions. So this, in my opinion, is the worst form of pseudoscience. Ideologically motivated propaganda, pseudoscience, because it does the exact opposite of what science is supposed to do. Science is supposed to challenge our assumptions to get to some fundamental understanding of the world, of nature. This is imposing parochial, bigotry onto science.
Exactly.
And sort of making science its bitch. And it's a complete offense. To anything scientific or rational. Just terrible.
What amazes me is just how, I mean, this is a post-grad. This is, right? This is a graduate student. It's not an 11-year-old. And the experiments and the arguments are just so utterly simplistic that it's so incongruous. And you know what upset me almost as much as the other stuff is what he said about pie. He proved, that.
Does he not like it?
That pie.
That it's what, 3.14?
That pie, that 22/7 is not a good approximation. It's not pie. It's like, as everyone thinks it is. Like, whoa, wait a second. That's just an approximation that's been used for what, 2 millennia? Everyone
wait,
knows.
Wait, but what does that have to do with the gates?
Nothing. It's got nothing to do. But it just shows you that.
It just shows that the guy's a genius, Rebecca.
Rebecca, this guy is turning science on its head.
You get the flavor when you read the article that you're dealing with a mental illness. You know what I mean? I hate to just invoke that, but when you start saying things like, oh, I've proved the world wrong about pi. Really, guy? Really? I mean, come on. That's somebody's, full of themselves to the point of it being diagnosable.
And it wasn't just him though, Steve. I mean, he was backed by, other seemingly prominent or, learned scientists. Like this.
Well, that's where the propaganda angle, I think, came in. You know, this is just state sponsored propaganda. And homophobia is rampant on the African continent.
Nigeria has really harsh anti-homosexuality laws.
Yeah.
So.
And they want science to prove their politics correct. That's what it's about.
They get burned with all the other witches and albino children and everything else.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, and that's the key thing, I think. It shows the power of rationalization. They're so invested in this belief and in their homophobia that they will go to unbelievable lengths, which we have seen so many other ways.
Yes. But this is no different than what was happening 100 years ago. It's just that they're 100 years out of date. This is like old school pseudoscience. This is Nazi pseudoscience,
Yeah, like this is a different – 100 years ago, somebody might have gotten killed after this guy put that paper out,
Well, and today somebody – there was a death sentence being considered in Uganda for homosexuality supported by American evangelicals. So it's not completely out there that this sort of thing will also lead to the murders of other people. And especially not even just, state sanctioned murders, but it contributes to an overall rejection of homosexual people as people. It dehumanizes them. It makes them criminals and it makes them easy targets for anybody who wants to kill them. So when you see a hate crime against anyone on the LGBTQ spectrum, I think you can thank things like this. It all feeds into it.
It makes me angry to see science used in this way. First of all, this guy had to have gotten a formal education to be at that school and go through what he's going through. It saddens me to think a scientist or someone that is supposed to be trained in critical thinking could even approach thoughts like this.
Ideology trumps it, all that.
Yeah, it's exactly what we talked about last week, that study that talked about how your political views can bias the way you even process math. I think this is maybe a really good example of that.
All right, we're going to end the new segment with a light bit of pseudoscience. Evan.
Yay!
Yet another, local news story telling us about a miracle cure that regrows fingers.
Can you believe it? And it comes out of Miami, Florida, courtesy of CBS Miami. And from the first line of their article, it reads, "It is being called a medical marvel. A South Florida doctor used a unique procedure to actually grow back a man's finger that a horse bit off." His name's Paul Halpern. He's 33. He arrived at the hospital with his finger in a Ziploc bag. And his insurance company said, why don't we just amputate the rest of the finger? But a doctor wanted to try a unique procedure.
That first of all, right there, that doesn't smell right.
Exactly.
What the insurance company had a rep in the hospital telling him how to practice medicine. No, just stop it. That's just nonsense.
Yeah, it doesn't pass the smell test. Supposedly an advanced and cutting edge without any surgery or amputation, the general surgeon, whose name is Eugenio Rodriguez, said he could make the finger grow back. Using the bladder tissue of a pig, Dr. Rodriguez made a template of Halpern's finger and attached it to what was left. The finger's cells, bone, soft tissue, even the nail grew into the mold. And the doctor said, it's very interesting to see a patient heal. That's my passion, wound healing. It's fascinating to have these new results. All right. So do you folks remember us talking about finger regeneration, pig bladders and stuff way back in 2007 when we talked about a fellow who lost the end of his finger and
Lee Spiewak.
Yes, Lee Spiewak.
Yep.
And his brother offered him some magic fairy dust, a powder that you were sprinkle on the wound.
Cocaine, Jack!
Derived? No, it's...
My finger grew back. You're just super high, Jack.
the extract of pig bladder. And apparently with remarkable, incredible results, the man's digit returned. Now, when we talked about that particular article many years ago, what was it? The very tip of his finger? I mean, he had not even, I think, lost part or most of his nail was still intact. In fact, it really wasn't much of a finger injury, I think, as we commented on the time, and that, you know, to say that the pig bladder had a, you know, miraculous healing property involved with this was, you know, very speculative at its time. Now, in this more recent news article, the fellow from Miami, it's reported that he lost a third of his finger, which if you think about it is a significant chunk. You would think just about to the first knuckle, that you lose at that point when you're losing a third of your finger. So what happened here? Well, you know, I took a look at the pictures, which, you know, they mosaic out. I don't know why. Was it because, did you guys see that?
Yeah, they blur out the money shot.
Yeah, I wonder why.
So how are we supposed to really have some kind of sense of how damaged this finger was, A, to begin with, and how it regenerated?
I searched around. I found pictures showing the fresh wound. It's not even below the nail bed. So yeah. Once again, it's the tip of the finger. The nail grew back. The tip of the finger healed just normally. It's absolutely nothing miraculous about this. The one third of his finger, my ass, that was a complete exaggeration. It's the same exact case as the one from 2008. It was a mangled end of the finger that, you know, you still have the nail bed. Guess what? Your nail's going to regrow. That's it.
There are stem cells in the tips of your fingers that add to that fast healing that occurs that does allow the ends of your fingers to what would appear to be regenerate. And they say as long as you've got that nail intact, which is kind of creates the link that you need to the rest of the body so that the bone can heal and everything else, you could really get your finger back, basically. There was an article, I'll wrap it up with this. There was an article earlier this year, back in June, in Nature Magazine reports that there have been studies in which they've amputated toes from mice. And what they did find out is that as long as some of the nail bed was still there in the mice, they would be able to really fully grow back the entire part of the digit that was gone. But for those that they amputated in which no nail bed was still present, it would not grow back.
Yeah. This guy had nail bed. So nothing miraculous about it.
So there you go.
All right. Thanks,
it's
Evan.
It's resolved. Yep.
All right, Evan. Last week for Who's That Noisy, we had a little contest. What happened with that?
We did. And we asked listeners to submit their favorite line from a movie having to deal with a skeptical nature, your favorite skeptical quote of any kind from any movie. And the suggestions came pouring in. Some of them were pretty interesting. We also received song lyrics and quotes from television shows, which I kind of wasn't really expecting, but it made me think. And why not? Let's do this. We're going to extend this. We're going to extend this another week. And we're going to allow you, the listeners, to also submit not only your favorite skeptical movie quote, but your skeptical song lyric that you enjoy the most, or your favorite skeptical phrase from a television show. So we are broadening the selections from which we will pull out our favorite ones, and we will reveal them next week. And I think we're going to have multiple winners. Multiple names are going to go into the hat. And this is the only time we're doing this year, in which there will be multiple winners on a given week. So go ahead and send us your submissions. Now, in the meantime, I have prepared a new Who's That Noisy, actually, for this week.
It is a great honor for me to take part in this motion picture tribute to my boyhood hero, Dr. Robert Goddard, and to discuss his contributions to science.
Okay. Boyhood hero, Robert Goddard, his contributions to science. Who is that? Who is saying that? Tell us, WTN@theskepticsguide.org, or go ahead and post it on our message board, which is sguforums.com, and we'll have two winners, at least two winners. I think we're going to have more than two next week on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
All right, let's go on to emails. First email comes from John Dawson from Perth, Western Australia. And John writes, OMG, I found this rubbish on a crowdfunding website. They have raised $17,197 towards this project. Can you believe it? Make it stop. Okay, I vented. I'm done.
Huh.
John gives us a link to an Indiegogo.com project called Home Quantum Energy Generator. Now, we got this email before the Indiegogo project was completed. But in the interim, it has actually completed, and they did meet their goals. They successfully raised $18,064 for their project. Both Jay and I independently emailed the people at Indiegogo.
Mm-hmm.
I quoted extensively from their own rules saying that they, you know, don't allow fraud. basically, and I said, this is actually fraud. You are allowing someone to defraud the users of your website. Please check into this. I got the generic email back. I'm sure you did too, Jay. Like, thanks.
Oh, yeah.
We're checking into it, and I never heard back from them after that.
You got the form letter.
I also flagged my response as a bad response. Like, I wasn't satisfied with it. And I emailed them yet again through another channel, and I didn't get a response. So, sadly, I think Indiegogo just flat out doesn't care about fraud.
Well, what are we seeing here? What is the fraud?
It's a perpetual motion machine.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's as simple as that. And I love how they actually pulled out the, let's see, what's their quote here? The machines get their input from the quantum field, of course, which is estimated to have in the neighborhood of 200 megawatts of power available in every cubic foot of space. If, you know, if that were the case, the universe would be an entirely different beast if there was that much energy in every cubic foot of space.
It's right.
And that's just one of the things that leaped out at me. It was just all over the place with just the usual, you know, free energy stuff. It's just like one after the other. It's like, do something different at least, you know, just,
Well, if it ain't broke.
They keep reinventing this same scam over and over and over again. Yeah. And it's often some variation on the spinning magnets, you know? It's like, look, if you arrange the magnets just so, you can get the wheel to keep spinning. Yeah, okay, it'll go for a while, but it's not generating energy. You're not going to be running your house off of this thing, or they have it connected to a motor.
Does it have little dolphins on either end? Because I think I remember seeing that at World of Science.
Yeah.
But Steve, I'm not even convinced that the guy who's supposedly inventing this thing isn't aware that it's a scam.
Well, it's indistinguishable, right? You can't know. How would you know? The same kind of rhetoric and would be used either way. Again, it's beyond parody. It's a self-parody. There's nothing different that you would do if you tried to make a parody of it, right? Yeah. And it's another Poe.
Nothing different at all, because we've seen this so many times before. I mean, guys, we've been in skepticism for decades now, and how many times have we seen the exact same thing coming down the pike?
It's perpetual, Evan. So the older scam was you get investors, right? You announce, oh, we got this machine. It's going to change the world. You know, just need a certain amount of money. Now they're just updating that to crowdsourcing. Sure there are more of these out there. This is just somebody flagged us on this one. I bet you if we really look on Kickstarter and Indiegogo, this is probably not the only such scam to get funded.
I'd be interested in seeing Kickstarter's response to something like this, because in the past they've been really receptive to their audience. So it surprises me that Indiegogo would be so difficult to deal with.
Or just ignoring it altogether.
Or maybe they believe it. I mean, they could be credulous as well. You know, they're not necessarily skeptics at Indiegogo.
Or I think more likely they throw up their hands and think, well, I don't know what this mumbo jumbo means. This guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about. So what do I know? Don't you think that's more likely? Like they just have no idea.
Yeah. No, I mean, guys, don't ever forego the idea that there's malfeasance on the corporate level when it comes to greed. Yeah. You know, there's, it's a $17,000-$18,000 campaign and they're making money off of it.
Yeah. But the person dealing with customer complaints is not the president or CEO, is just some person who will look at this and just be like, well, I have other things to do with my day. You know, like I don't know, never, what is the quote? Don't ascribe to blah,
yeah,
blah, blah.
Yeah, don't ascribe to malfeasance what could, like, simple incompetence can explain.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. But again, we just don't know. But it doesn't really even matter. I didn't tell them I'm hosting a science podcast and I'm going to make fun of your of Indiegogo if you don't answer me, but...
Oh, you probably should have led with that.
So. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Lead with it.
Well, also, there is a, my opinion, responsibility here. You know, you're this type of website, they need to have someone that can figure this kind of stuff out. I mean, one science-minded person on their staff to, or, you know, I'm sure
they claim to, vet their programs so that they don't defraud the users, and they failed. So if they're sincere in their own, documents, they just failed on this case.
And if they don't know for themselves, how much effort could it take for them to really figure out exactly what this is? I think in 5 or 10 minutes they would realize.
I sent them the links. I did the work for them. Like, here you go. This is it's a scam. Yeah, I didn't have to do any work.
Yeah, but you know how much you do a Google search on this stuff, and you'll find the overwhelming preponderance of stuff that makes it sound reasonable, and the scientists don't know what they're talking about. I mean, going from nothing. I don't think in 5 or 10 minutes you could really appreciate the complexity of this topic. And, you know, unless you've been a skeptic for a while, I mean, I don't think it's a quick fix. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's difficult for people who aren't versed in this. They have no idea of what free energy is, what, you know, the stuff that we talk about all the time. It's completely foreign to them. I can see them just throwing up their hands.
Yeah. Except then they have to be thinking to themselves, well, where's all the free energy devices? Where are these hundreds of thousands of devices that have been promised over the years? How come none of them are in operation?
They just needed $18,000, Evan, and now they're going to change the world.
Well, and that's the goal of these websites, though, is to help people who have big ideas that once someone comes up with them, everybody's like, oh, I wish I had thought of that. But these people don't necessarily have the funding to do it. So this fits right in with what Indiegogo are all about. Like, oh, these guys figured out this awesome new energy producing machine. They just need some money. Perfect.
They need to hire skeptics is what they need to do.
I mean, yes. Yeah, I'm not making excuses for them.
No, I know.
You know, I'm just, trying to put it into context.
Yeah, it's not a quick fix.
All right, let's go on.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. No theme this week, you'll be happy to know. Just 3 regular news items.
Themeless.
Are you all ready?
We're ready.
All right, here we go. Item number 1, a new study finds that beauty sleep is real. Patients who were treated for poor sleep were rated as more attractive following treatment. Item number 2, researchers find that cats infected with the Toxoplasma parasite are more affectionate and likely to lick other animals, including humans, increasing the spread of the parasite. Item number 3, scientists have discovered a method for converting mature skin cells into stem cells with near-perfect efficiency by removing a single protein. Bob, go first.
All right, so we got beauty sleep is real. Yeah, sure, why not? So many benefits to a good sleep. I could definitely see how it would help with the appearance of your skin tone or whatever. You know, maybe blood circulation to the skin. So yeah, I can kind of buy that one. Cats infected with toxoplasma you have. Isn't it toxoplasmosis or something?
That's the disease. Toxoplasma is the organism.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's in the dirt outside, Bob.
Gotcha. So the cats are more affectionate and likely to lick other animals, including humans, increasing the spread. So isn't the deal with that is that the mice are like really brave when they're infected and they just like aren't afraid of cats at all. Yeah, I'm not sure about that one. I'm not sure about that one. Cats and the word affectionate just are not in the same sentence. I don't understand that.
What?
So,
whoa.
Maybe your cat.
All right. I have met a few
Stop
cats
abusing
in my
your
day.
Cat, Bob.
Here come the claws.
I know, seriously, Bob. No. My cat sleeps next to me all night, every night, and is like a freak show with affection.
Mine That's, too.
Okay, I have met a couple cats. And Jay, I took care of a cat for a week, a few weeks ago. And the cat was affectionate. So yeah, but it just,
Bob, that's just like that, saying you have a black friend. Okay. That's lame.
No, it's just that.
Stop being species.
Seriously, Bob.
I want.
It's just like, compared to dogs, cats are just totally lame when it comes to affection.
No, they're not, Bob. They're not.
Just keep digging that hole.
All right.
My cats are affectionate when they want food. They get really affectionate when they want food.
Cats are amazing. I love many aspects of cats, but just their aloofness. I just like them. I just prefer dogs. So kill me. Let's see. Let's move on, shall we? New method for converting mature skin cells into stem cells. Yeah, sure. Just single protein. Yeah, I don't have much of a problem with that one either. It's just the cat thing. I'm not buying the thing with the toxoplasma, and the cats. So I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
Yeah, the beauty sleep one, that makes perfect sense to me. I've heard this before. I'm not sure if it was a scientific study, but I'm pretty sure. Yeah, there's getting a good amount of sleep causes a huge change. Like, you can tell when someone's had a bad night of sleep. You can tell immediately. And it's not because they look better. I don't know about the mature skin cells into stem cells. It's awesome if it's true. But the cat one, okay, the reason why I think that that one is the fake is because as an animal lover and an owner of cats, and probably a carrier of toxoplasma, toxoplasmosis, I know that, if you want to avoid it, you should avoid kitty litter, especially if the cats go outside. And I believe that that's because the life cycle of toxoplasma, it requires being in the digestive system of a cat and before it can infect a human. And so I don't think it would actually want to be spread. You know, we hear about parasites all the time changing behavior of hosts in order to encourage their spread. But in this case, it would not behoove the parasite to be spread before it had gone through the digestive system of the cat. So for that reason, I think that that one is the fake.
Jay?
Okay. The beauty sleep one, absolutely. I think that's science. I'm definitely going to agree with Rebecca on this one about the toxoplasmosis. Plasmotoxosis. The thing that you said that makes me think it's weird, Steve, is that it makes the cat want to lick more. For some reason, that just doesn't seem right to me. So it's the fake.
And Evan.
Well, let's see. How am I going to stand alone on this one? I can't do that. Can I do that? I could do that. I'm not going to do that.
Take one for the team.
Nah, it's the more affectionate part. Yeah, Bob, I was thinking similar things to you. The parasites that take over the behaviors of animals. We've talked about that before, and insects and some other things. I don't have a cat. I grew up with lots of cats. My mom, you can consider her halfway to becoming the old cat lady. She's got about a half dozen of them and takes care of ones that live outside and so forth. And for all the other reasons my cohorts say, I will choose that one is the fiction.
Good man.
Yeah.
All right. You guys are all unanimous this week. So let's take these in order, I guess. Number one, a new study finds that beauty sleep is real. Patients who were treated for poor sleep were rated as more attractive following treatment. You guys all think that one is obviously science. And that one is science.
Hooray.
Good so far.
Yes. Uh-huh. I'm doing good now.
Time to sleep.
Yeah. So this was looking at patients suffering from sleep apnea. And it was a study following up on anecdotal observations that patients, 1 to 2 months after being treated successfully with CPAP, continuous positive airway pressure, you put that face mask on, it keeps your airway open so you don't get the obstruction that interferes with your sleep, that they look not just healthier, not just better rested, but actually more attractive.
Nice.
Wow.
And yeah, the study actually confirmed that they had.
But don't you think those things are the same? Like, better rested, looking better rested is looking more attractive.
Yeah, so I guess so. But what they did find was that the typical like bags under your eyes thing, they didn't see that with the people who were not well slept. And they used measures of attractiveness that tools for measuring that objectively that have been developed for plastic surgery. Hmm. So they were adapting those tools. So it wasn't just like, oh, what do you think this person looks like? It was more, you know, kind of objective scales that have been developed for that. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's interesting. They think that it may have been related to skin color. People who were well rested had less red skin. People who were sleep deprived had more red skin, and that made them just not as attractive.
Is that just white people?
It was more present among white people, yeah. So the redness was not as evident among darker skinned subjects in the study. That's right. So.
All right. Come on. Get to it.
Let's go on to number two. Researchers find that cats infected with the toxoplasma parasite are more affectionate and likely to lick other animals, including humans, increasing the spread of the parasite. You guys all think this is the fiction for various reasons. And this one is the fiction.
Yay!
Good job, everyone.
Yay.
Of course.
Meow.
Meow.
You suck, Steve.
Meow, meow.
Meow.
Rebecca, you pretty much nailed it. You definitely know the life cycle of the toxoplasma parasite.
I like parasites. What can I say?
Outdoor cats are more likely to have it than indoor cats. Indoor cats are very unlikely to get toxoplasma because you pretty much pick it up from eating mice, you know, small animals that have it. It is an obligate parasite in the cat GI systems of cat. That's part of its life cycle, has to be in the intestines of a cat. And the biggest risk is from the feces. But the study that I was going off of was one that showed, now it's been previously demonstrated, and I think we probably talked about this on the show, that when toxoplasma infects the brains of mice, they lose their fear of cats.
That's what Bob said.
Yeah, they no longer flee the smell of the cat urine. They're actually slightly attracted to the smell of cat urine.
Mm-hmm.
What this study showed is that that change in the mouse's brain is permanent. It doesn't go away after the toxoplasma is cleared from their system. So it's not just the presence of the toxoplasma that changes the mice behavior. It's probably some change to the mouse's brain that the parasite is creating. So that was the new finding, that lack of fear of cats, being attracted to mouse urine, to cat urine, is not just during the infective phase. It survives even after you treat and remove the infection. And that lack of fear is an adaptive trait of the toxoplasma to make it more likely for the infected mice to be eaten by cats and then move on to their next stage in their life cycle. All of this means that, number three, scientists have discovered a method for converting mature skin cells into stem cells with near-perfect efficiency by removing a single protein is science.
Wow.
And, yeah, this is quite a breakthrough. By near-perfect efficiency, what that means is almost 100% of the treated cells are turned into stem cells. That's 10 times greater than previous methods.
Mm. Whoa, an order of magnitude. Damn.
Yeah. Which had about a 10% efficiency. So yeah, so it's almost 100%. And also by removing a single protein. So.
What kind of stem cells, Steve?
Well, okay. So I mean, they're pluripotent stem cells. They're not totipotent. So they're not as good as embryonic stem cells, for example.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. But that's still pretty good. I mean, you know, it remains to be seen how useful they will be in specific clinical applications, but it's still, you know, fantastic that we could make pluripotent stem cells out of skin cells, you know, so easily and so efficiently. You know, it's turned out to be a lot easier than anybody thought it was going to be, you know. If you remember, a couple years ago, we reported on the Japanese scientists who discovered that just by changing four genes, you could turn mature cells into stem cells. Now it seems like you can do it by removing a single protein.
I could do that with one protein.
With one protein. But it still doesn't completely obviate the need for embryonic stem cells, you know, other sources of stem cells. But who knows? It may one day.
Steve, could you mention briefly what the difference between pluripotent and embryonic stem cells are?
So a stem cell is a cell that is a dedifferentiated or undifferentiated cell that can turn into other cells. If you think about development, you start out as a single cell, right? That single cell can turn into every single kind of cell in the body. It could turn into a liver cell, a brain cell, a bone cell, a muscle cell. It's totipotent. It could turn into any kind of cell. As that cell matures and differentiates into different types of tissue, then it dedicates itself to a subset of cell types. It becomes, the farther down that path it goes, the more differentiated it is, the more it loses its ability to turn into other types of cells. Now, even mature, adults have stem cells in their body. Your bone marrow has stem cells that make all the different kinds of blood cells, right? The term pluripotent means that you have a stem cell that could turn into many other types of cells. Totipotent is any other kind of cell. Essentially, it has to be an embryonic stem cell so early in the development that it still can be. It's like when you have twins, identical twins, the early clump of cells, I think they call it a blastocyst. If it divides in two, each one could become a full person, even though it's already divided a little bit. So when you're in that early stage, each cell can still become an entire person. It still retains its full potency, totipotent stem cell properties. Yeah.
I just want to apologize to everyone. I did not intend to elicit such a long answer.
I blacked out. I don't know how long we've been here.
Yeah, so Bob, I'm still pissed off at you about the whole cat thing.
Yeah, you really cat hate. Yeah.
You've got to rethink that.
Seriously. I really do have outrageously affectionate cats. You should come and meet them, and your whole opinion of cats will be changed.
Maybe they have toxoplasma.
Rebecca does.
They're very dog-like. One of them plays fetch. Uh-huh. And
the other one barks
a lot.
So dog-like is better. Is that what you're saying? Okay. Awesome.
The other one plays poker.
I have two cats. One is very affectionate. The other is the original scaredy cat. This cat is like constantly on alert and will run away. What's funny is whenever he thinks I'm moving in his direction, he'll run away from me, and his preferred path is to go up the stairs. So of course, every time I go up the stairs, he thinks I'm chasing him because I'm like following his escape route all the way up until he gets into the corner that he likes to go into. Yeah.
Feline paranoia.
All right. Well, good job this week, everyone.
Thank you.
Well done.
Jay, hello.
Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I have a quote.
Quote me.
I'd just like to thank Andrew Antero from Calgary, Alberta, Canada for sending in that awesome Breaking Bad audio file.
Calgary.
All right, on to the quote. This quote was sent in by someone well known to us, all of us, Evil Eye from the message board. And he was so smart to send me a quote from one of my all-time favorite movies, Young Frankenstein.
Ooh.
Did you guys know that Mel Brooks made Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein in the same year?
Whoa.
Yes, nice. He did. 75?
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I think it was. Nice. Evan.
Epic. Anyway, so here's the quote. This is from Dr. Frederick Frankenstein. Right. No, no.
Frederick Frankenstein.
Frederick. No, no. Be of good cheer. If science teaches us anything, it teaches us to accept our failures as well as our successes with quiet dignity and grace. And of course, he says this when his experiment has just failed, and then the very next thing he does is throw a total conniption. So,
epic tantrum. I want to die. Oh man, I got to see that movie. I haven't seen it in years. We got to watch that. Get it on Blu-ray and let's watch it.
Frederick Frankenstein.
Yep. So I'd like to thank Evil Eye for setting that in. Epic quote from an epic movie.
Yes. Even the Broadway play was awesome.
It was.
It was.
Steve, I want to share some good news with our SGU members right now. The premium content will soon be made available as a password-protected RSS feed. This means that everyone that's emailed in asking, can we get that premium content and the ad-free version of the show, can we get that in a feed? And we were trying to figure out how to do it. Well, my developer figured out how to do it. And now you'll be able to access the premium content from any podcast catching software if and only if it supports password protected RSS feeds. That's the only thing I have to hold back. You need to check your podcast software to see if it can support this. And we've tested this on iTunes only and it works fine. But beyond that, I just don't know if it's going to work. But I hear that a lot of other podcasts have password protected RSS feeds and most people don't have a problem with it.
Tell us if you use a specific podcast application, let us know if it works or doesn't work and we'll keep track of that. And also we are developing our own app with which you can listen to the SGU, including premium content and ad-free versions of the show. And of course that will have direct access to the premium content.
Yep. And we'll be sending you an email soon, hopefully within a week, to give you all the information that you need about the password protected RSS.
Hey, you guys, I'm going to be at Skepticon in Springfield, Missouri, November 15th through
17th. Awesome.
Great.
Skepticon.org. Even if you're not around, you can go donate and help them out because it's a free conference in the Bible Belt, which is an amazing feat. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. N.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.